That's a good point. So, yeah, I mean, you are penalized if you destroy a wetland in East Tennessee and you mitigate in West Tennessee. It costs you more, is what it comes down to. And a lot of the mitigation banks occur in West Tennessee. So when Turkey Creek was, you know, part of it, of its wetland was filled in, then, you know, it's within the region that wetland hasn't been replaced. It has been in the state of Tennessee within the banking system, and it's been in West Tennessee where there's a few more wetlands, but yeah, that they pay for that ultimately. Is that good or bad? I mean, I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's a penalty ultimately. The penalty is greater for going outside the region.
But it doesn't justify it.
Yeah, does it justify it? I know. That is the system that's set up. And so those are good points. Other comments?
So what happens to those wetlands? Do they become privately owned, or are they owned by the state, federal?
So are they privately owned? Well, the ones that are filled in usually are privately owned. But the mitigation ones, it depends on, usually they're publicly owned. Usually it's public domain because it, most of those agencies in the mitigation bank are public agencies, so they're dealing with public land. Yeah. So maybe that's also another benefit, is you have more wetlands for public use as well. Lots of negatives and lots of positives, and certainly I don't think there's a, it's just the system that's in place now. Okay, so we already talked about the 86-87 manual. There is a link to that manual on your website if you were so inclined to read through the 45 pages of wonderful text that it's composed of. It's not required reading, though. One other thing. In 1985, in the Farm Bill, Food Security Act, there's the Farm Bill. Part of the Farm Bill is a swamp buster provision, okay? The swamp buster provision is a piece of legislation that was added to the Farm Bill that penalizes landowners, penalizes producers for developing planting in wetlands, okay? So if you go down into a wetland, well, first of all, there are a couple things. If you just go and plant within a wetland, all right, you have a wetland, you disc it up, and you try to get maybe a crop of beans off of that. That is completely illegal. But if your crop floods out, you will not get any federal subsidies. Okay? That's one aspect of the swamp buster provision. Okay? For that site, okay? Now, if you actually violate the Clean Water Act by filling in a wetland, and you are caught as a farmer, then you lose all the subsidies on your, that you own. All the subsidies that you would receive for your property. And that includes the farm that it's associated with and any other farm. If they farm outside the state that the infraction occurred, all those subsidies, they will not receive any subsidies. Moreover, if it's found that you were in default, that this occurred years before, they're required to return all of the subsidies that they received back to the point in which that violation happened. So it is a pretty, I mean, it's a piece of legislation that has a lot of teeth in the agricultural world, where a lot of wetlands have been lost have been filled in for agricultural purposes. So in 85, this was put in, and unless you're, and there are violations and infractions that occur in the state of Tennessee, a couple ongoing right now, there's like two or three, and they're being investigated, but it doesn't happen too often, and reporting enforcement is very difficult. In fact, there really aren't folks driving around looking for infractions. It happens to come from word of mouth and neighbors calling on other neighbors. Maybe they don't like each other and they know that you're not supposed to do that. Or maybe it is a biologist that drives by and sees it and knows it. This is, you know, a big deal. Our farmers depend, their livelihood depends on receiving federal subsidies. So it does, it's behooves them to try to fill in a wetland. It's a risk for them to try to plant a wetland, but some will still do it. Especially last year, it was worth the risk, and a lot of folks ended up getting money off of disking up a wetland and planting a crop of beans, assuming that the beans got enough water during the drought. Okay, so another, this is separate though from the Clean Water Act, this is obviously the Food Security Act, Farm Bill, okay, and Swamp Buster provision of it. So be aware of the Swamp Buster provision. Any, you want to add any comments, Melissa, at all on that? Swamp Buster provision stuff, okay. You guys got any questions? All right, so I mentioned here that there are two different permits that are issued. One's individual, one is general. The general permits, there's lots of different general permits, but one type of general permit that you will come in contact with as a biologist is what is called a nationwide permit. And there are two nationwide permits that pretty much are applicable for managing wetlands, and that's why I bring them up. Nationwide permit 27 and 30, and there are several other nationwide permits that I think are outlined in handout 3. Okay, just as a list, you don't need to remember all these, just remember these two that I'm putting on, that are on the slide. I will mention here, since I forgot to, handout number 2. This is just kind of an overview of really wetland regulation history. And who regulates wetlands? That will be a question on the bottom. Who regulates wetlands? Number 1, who regulates wetlands? Everybody knows that now. Yeah, the Corps of Engineers regulates wetlands on a federal level. There may be state laws as well, which we'll talk about that in a bit. And they're the regulatory authority. Now, Fish and Wildlife Service may come into play if there are threatened or endangered species, like they always do, in a wetland. It could be a wetland or terrestrial or aquatic, okay? But they would come into play in those cases. And EPA would come into play if there are contaminants that may be of issue within a wetland area, okay? But the Corps regulates the dredging, the definition, the delineation of a wetland, definition, delineation of a wetland, and any filling of a wetland. All right. So, Nationwide 27 and 30. 27 is for stream and wetland restoration activities. It authorizes the filling and dredging of wetlands that will result in the creation, restoration, enhancement of wetlands. It does not authorize stream channelization or diversion. Okay? So, stream or wetland restoration. This would be a case where you're maybe building a new moist soil impoundment and you're building new levees to retain water, and you need a permit to do that. You're actually, as you build the levee, you're filling in portions of a wetland, and you have to get a permit to do that. Second is Nationwide 30, which is moist soil management. Not the manipulation of water, not burning, not mowing, but if it breaks the soil, so for example, disking wetlands, you need a permit. It's kind of ironic because any farmer can go in the process of planting a crop and disk a wetland, and they do not need a permit because it is in the process, it's called a bona fide agricultural technique. You're going in and you're actually in the process of trying to plant. That's okay. But if you're a wildlife biologist doing the same thing, even though it's a disk, okay, it's the same disk, but you're doing it to set back succession is what we do use this for, which we'll talk a lot about later. You need a permit. All right, and that's covered under Nationwide 30. Now, there is a form for both of these. It's called the ENG 4345 form. And it's submitted to the district office in your region, which for us in East Tennessee is Nashville. If you're in West Tennessee, it's Memphis. Now, if you work for a state agent, like for TWRA, work for Fish and Wildlife Service, many agencies have these already filled out, have these already done, and so you don't have to worry about, you know, as a biologist about doing this stuff. Usually, though, I mean, if you are going to do some type of, like if you're going to build a new levee, you will probably have to get authorization to do that. But these are very quick. The nationwide permits, especially ones that deal with wildlife habitat management, there's just this form is 2 pages. It's not very long. It's pretty simple. There's some components to it, but it's a pretty easy thing to fill out. Once it's filled, approval usually takes place within 15 to 30 days, and no public review is required. Now, individual permits, which basically fall outside the general permits, the nationwide permits, which pretty much is anybody that is going to fill a wetland for development. Okay, they fill out the same forms, but it requires a 15-day public notice, at least 15 days. There is then a 15 to 30-day comment period where the public, government agencies, NGOs, etc., can provide comments. The Corps then considers those comments and then can call a public hearing and have additional comments and discussion. And this can go on and on and on and on for a long time. In fact, in order for Turkey Creek to get approval for some of the wetlands, well, for the wetlands that were destroyed there, this went on for quite a long time. So it could go on for years. Normally, it gets done within about 60 days. And this is another statistic, is that only a fraction of the permits that are submitted are denied. They would be ones that really rise to high public controversy, and for the most part, their permits are submitted, applications are submitted, permits are given all the time, and this whole process goes on without us even knowing, really. Hey, without us even knowing, and mitigating and all that stuff. Okay. A little bit about permitting. Good?
If you don't have a wetland and you're building one, you don't have to do this, right? Like, say you own 100 acres and you want to build a levee for waterfowl or what have you. There's not a wetland present. You're creating one. You still have to have a permit.
So, yeah. Do you need a permit in an area that's not a wetland? No, you don't. However, once you create the wetland, You are changing the normal circumstances to it now being a wetland. And once those characteristics become established, it is a jurisdictional wetland. So you can't just go and yank out the levee whenever you want if it becomes a wetland. Other questions? Now we'll talk a little bit here, well, I guess we're kind of going on in just a second, about really what is actually a jurisdictional wetland. It can be a wetland, but is it covered under federal law? And again, basically the way it was interpreted is that anything that was could be classified as a wetland ultimately was a wetland, what was a jurisdictional wetland, and it could be covered under federal law and you could not fill it in. And then it was also interpreted that you could not dig it out either, dredge it. The rule that actually, there was a rule that was put in place called the Tulloch Rule that prevented the dredging of wetlands. And what the Tulloch Rule said was that if you went into a wetland and you were dredging the wetland, that the fill that falls back in, because you can't just, you know, when you're pulling it up, you're going to have some fill that comes out of the bucket of the excavator or whatever you're using to dig that wetland out. That fill can be considered incidental fallback, and that can be classified as fill. Therefore, by dredging, you're filling, and therefore dredging constitutes filling. I know, that's a weird way to think about it, but the rule was put in place by the Corps, by one of the colonels that was in charge, and it just went. And so even though the Clean Water Act said only filling, then dredging was put in place in the mid-80s. And that ran until 1999, until ultimately somebody took to the Supreme Court. All right, now the back of this number two talks about the Tulloch Rule. And you can read up about that. But the Tulloch Rule stated that incidental fallback from dredging activities constituted fill, hence this legislation prevented the dredging of wetlands. In 99, that was overturned. It said no, incidental fallback does not constitute fill. If you dredge, you legally can dredge a wetland. Okay? That also means simultaneously that you can legally drain a wetland. Are you all hearing this? You can legally dig a ditch and drain the wetland and remove the hydrology from it. If it's a federally controlled wetland, you can still do that. All right? But you have to take all your fill with you, or most of it, you know? You can't dig it and then just pile it up. You have to take it with you. And that is legal. Dredging, ditching a wetland is legal. Straight to the Supreme Court, okay? And the point was, when the decision was made, is that that was never the intent of the Clean Water Act. Remember, courts function to interpret the law. And the Tulloch Rule probably was, well, it was, it's been decided, was a poor rule and a poor interpretation of what the Clean Water and the intent of the Clean Water Act was. It was not meant to stop dredging, it was meant to stop filling, and this does not constitute fill. Still can't fill, but you can dredge and ditch and actually drain the wetland. And then it becomes not jurisdictional anymore. Okay. And then you can fill the thing. Yeah.
How long after you drain a wetland does it not become a wetland? Let's say you try to keep
I would say it depends on if you put any, you know, structures in there to keep it dry, but it is from a jurisdictional standpoint until it becomes a normal circumstance. Till basically the majority of the years, it does not have wetland characteristics. So over, you would have to demonstrate that over, you know, a period of probably 6 to 8 years. I mean, it would probably immediately stop having those characteristics. I mean, if the water just, you know, it's like a bathtub or something. You know, water goes in and goes out. It's going to lose those characteristics pretty quick. Except, you know, at the lowest points, it'll probably still retain some, but up the fringes, it would lose it pretty quick. Okay. So that was a pretty good blow there. But at the same time, it was, it's pretty understandable decision. Okay, so the dredging of wetlands is legal under federal law. The second decision is called the Swank decision, and that is handout number 4. Swank stands for the one that has the DU website. SWANC stands for, is an acronym that stands for Solid Waste Agency of North Cook County. And they took on the Corps of Engineers, went to the Supreme Court, and basically SWANC, this group, there's a gravel pit that they purchased outside of Chicago. Massive gravel pit that had been being built over years or constructed over years and years and years. And they bought it from this quarry, I guess. Well, over time, water had obviously accumulated in there and wetland characteristics were starting to form. Okay, and they were going to go in and fill it because this is a waste company. They want to basically create a fill and have it as a dump. And Corps of Engineers stopped them and said, no, you're filling a wetland in this relatively unnatural setting. Okay, but this is where court cases are won. The SWANC, the protection of an isolated wetland like that started with another rule that was implemented in the 80s by the Corps, which is called the Migratory Bird Rule. So make sure you write that down. Migratory Bird Rule. The Swank decision resulted in the overturning of the Migratory Bird Rule. Migratory Bird Rule said, all right, now remember, Clean Water Act says you can't fill navigable waters. Well, how does a gravel pit constitute navigable water was the question. But simultaneously, how does just a natural isolated wetland, a depressional wetland, like we have some that are up on the plateau, there are depressional wetlands that aren't associated with any type of drainage at all. Okay? They're just depressional. They have their own drainage. All of the wetlands that are carved out throughout the Great Plains of the Midwestern United States, going up into Canada, the Prairie Pothole region, that were carved out by glaciers. Okay? All of those are independent. The Playa Lakes that I showed you earlier, the southern Great Plains that are wind-formed depressional wetlands. So obviously you don't see any barges going by there, right? So I mean, how does this how can these be even considered jurisdictional? the migratory bird rule said that because migratory birds represent commerce, they are part, especially waterfowl, okay? They are part of interstate, of intrastate and interstate commerce. Folks harvest waterfowl. Because waterfowl cross state borders, they represent interstate commerce, and hence the isolated wetlands are functionally linked together and therefore can be considered not navigable, but at least they fall under the same context of the Clean Water Act, which was to maintain interstate commerce by not filling wetlands. And by filling in an isolated wetland, you're not maintaining interstate commerce because you're reducing the amount of habitat out there for migratory birds. And that flew until 2001. And it was overturned, and it said that's not the intention of the Clean Water Act. Sorry. Specifically deals with navigable waters. So now to date, you can fill in, overturn the migratory bird rule, protected isolated wetlands, not navigable, because they promoted interstate commerce by providing habitat to migratory water birds. 2003. Okay? So isolated wetlands are not protected under federal law. So you can dredge wetlands and you can fill in isolated wetlands. Okay? Clear? Now, any questions with those? Now, in 2006, Clean Water Act took another hit, or at least wetland protection on the Clean Water Act took another hit. Alive. I opened up the wrong presentation. Hold on for a second. There we go. There we go. Rapinos versus the United States. So then the next thing was, all right, it says navigable waters. Well, the way that was interpreted, it has been interpreted, is that, okay, certainly the Tennessee River is a navigable water, but you get off the Tennessee River and then it becomes questionable. What's navigable? What isn't navigable? So can you begin to fill in these tributaries that go into the Tennessee River, for example, and their associated wetlands? So the question came up of non-navigable tributaries. All right, this was the decision that was made, and it's outlined here in handout number 5. Okay? I'm going to outline them here. Jurisdictional wetlands are traditional navigable waters and their adjacent wetlands. Okay? So jurisdictional wetlands are navigable waters and their adjacent wetlands. That pretty much means that you're only dealing with wetlands associated with river type systems. Okay? Now, what does adjacent mean? We'll talk about that in just a second. They also include non-navigable waters that are relatively permanent and their adjacent wetlands. So non-navigable waters that are relatively permanent. Permanent means that there's at least 3 months of flowing water. Okay, so you have the Tennessee River and its associated wetlands. You have its tributaries that go up that aren't navigable. Those, if they're permanent, those are protected and they're associated wetlands. Okay? If they're not permanent, okay, so you need at least 3 months of flowing water to be considered permanent. So as you get higher in elevation, obviously you can have intermittent streams. If you're not permanent, I'll get to that in just a second. All right. Adjacency means, this is how it's defined. The adjacent wetlands means that there is surface water connection, at least sometime during the growing season. Well, actually, outside the growing season, it doesn't matter, but there has to be some type of surface water connection. All right. That is adjacency. So, again, navigable and non-navigable waters, as long as these are permanent. And they're adjacent wetlands, which means the wetlands in which they are connected via surface water. Okay. Also, wetlands that are non-navigable, that are ephemeral, so meaning that they're less than 3 months flowing water, and their adjacent wetlands are protected if it can be established that there is a significant nexus. A significant nexus means a significant connection. And that connection can be an ecological connection. Or that if you remove this wetland, you're going to affect the downstream water quality of a jurisdictional permanent wetland here, okay? Okay? And in that case where there's a significant nexus, you're a jurisdictional wetland as well. Wetlands also that are not directly adjacent to non-navigable waters that are relatively permanent can be included. So, again, you don't have the adjacency. They're not connected by water at some point. But those wetlands, so they may be near this waterway, but there might be a little ridge or something, and they aren't connected by surface water. But that wetland is permanent. It has water that's relatively permanent. Okay? Meets all the wetland criteria. And you can establish that there's a significant, at least ecological nexus or water quality nexus, then it's a jurisdictional wetland. All right. So, again, these characteristics, as I mentioned already, can be flow characteristics, so they contribute to the function of the tributary, or they can be ecological factors, such that there's some type of ecological connection with respect to the animals that live in these adjacent wetlands and in these wetlands and the permanent wetlands. They're a classic jurisdictional. Okay? So that significant nexus needs to be established. And that is up to the burden, ultimately, of the regulatory agencies to demonstrate this, which requires some knowledge of the system to regulate it. Okay? Is that clear? Now this was just in 2006, and the decision was made, and nobody knew anything. I have a buddy that does wetland consulting out in New Mexico, And I asked him, so what does this decision mean? He goes, I don't know. We have no idea. And it took about a year, and finally some guidance was released. It was by the Corps of Engineers, and I think EPA collectively released it last summer. And this is the guidance. This is the way it's being interpreted by these agencies. So this is how wetlands are being regulated now. Now this is a little scary because 59%, 60% of our tributaries are intermittent or ephemeral. So they fall into this need to establish a significant nexus. So I probably wouldn't mess around if I was a developer within a tributary, but before, where you could have adjacent wetlands, it would definitely be considered part of navigable waterways, even though they're not navigable. Now you could probably destroy those without even having to get a federal permit. And you know what? The Corps would be very hesitant to even try to mess with it because they're probably going to go to court. Probably get lose again. The problem is we do not have good federal wetland legislation. We're trying to protect wetlands under a law, an act, that it was not intended to really be under. That's the problem. Here we're sitting here, still looking at each other 30 years later, going, golly, this isn't working very well. And in the process, the wetlands are being lost at the sake of really not having effective legislation in place. Now, fortunately, let's see, what else do I have? Okay. Before I go on to that, so what are we talking? This really definitely, small washes, swales, and ditches are not protected, obviously, in these cases. But okay, fortunately, there are about half of our states that have. States have laws for wetland protection. Yeah, Daniel.
I have a question. What is considered navigable waters? Is that with a motor or do you do a canoe considered navigable?
Yeah, so what's considered? Now, the definition of navigable for the Corps deals with interstate commerce. So, I mean, you know, you could say that canoeing could be interstate commerce if you're somebody from another state, but what it really... The interpretation of it is that you're taking goods from one state to another. Okay? That would have to be a relatively large waterway. You'd have to have at least probably, you know, a large boat would have to be able to get down it. That would be considered a navigable water. Okay? So, yeah, I mean, you can certainly navigate with a smaller boat, a recreational boat, and those things might be considered interstate commerce. But, you know, that hasn't been interpreted yet. It currently, the way it stands is that if it's permanent and these things are connected, primarily because if you fill in one of these major non-navigable waterways, okay, it's going to affect that major navigable waterway. So that probably, those will hold. And we have lots of wetlands out there. We have tributaries out there that certainly this significant nexus has to be established. And then there are isolated wetlands all over the country that are highly important to wildlife in the country. Not just our country, throughout the Western Hemisphere. We talk about migratory birds, and you can dredge. You know, and dig it out anyways. Let it dry up and, you know, 5-10 years later or something like that, go in there and do what you want to do. Most developers are not that patient. They want things filled in. You know what, I don't care. How much is it? All right, you're going to charge me $200,000, boom, done, here you go, fill it in. And they give the money to the the mitigation bank. So, yeah.
Significant nexus, again, is ecological information, or if you remove the wetland, it has significant impact on downstream?
Yeah. So significant nexus, the nexus means connection. So you have to have a significant connection, and that connection can be ecological or it can be hydrological.
That's what they're trying to argue for, right?
Yes, you have to establish this. When you get into these cases where you have basically non-navigable waters and they're ephemeral, you have to establish there's a significant nexus with the down with the downstream navigable wetlands. Okay? Or the downstream non-navigable wetlands that are permanent. You have to establish. Well, if it's a stream reach, they're connected. You know, that doesn't take any, that will hold. What really comes to play is when you start talking about adjacent wetlands up in these upper reaches. Okay? And those, first of all, if they're ephemeral, forget it. But if they're more permanent for some reason, then you'd have to establish some type of ecological or hydrologic connection. Hydrologic connection, probably not going to have a very good luck with that. Ecological might be a challenge too. But you have to make a good case. You know, maybe amphibians are moving back and forth or something like that. yeah. Any other questions? Okay, one, before we go to the state stuff, one positive thing that happened last year for wetlands is what's called being called the Clean Water Restoration Act. Now, this isn't for wetland, well, it is for protecting wetlands, but it's for identifying certain wetlands in certain areas. So the goal here is to protect isolated wetlands and non-navigable intermittent waters that are deemed ecologically important. So the goal of this legislation will be to identify areas, specifically big areas like the Prairie Pothole region, the Playa Lake region, and probably some other important wetlands that the committee that is organizing this, who hopefully is getting scientific advice, which they are. They're getting advice from Ducks Unlimited and other agency, other natural resource agents, Fish and Wildlife Service, et cetera. It will protect certain types of wetlands in certain regions. This will not be a piece of legislation that basically protects wetlands across the United States. There'll still be other isolated wetlands and intermittent wetlands that don't fall under this class, the areas of ecological importance that still will not be covered under federal law. And I want to emphasize that this is all under federal law based on the Corps. Okay? So, how are wetlands protected from dredging? We have state laws, and there are about half the states have state laws that protect wetlands. So in Tennessee, wetlands are protected by water quality laws. It's kind of an interesting thing. Nobody's taken our stuff to court because we'll go through this, and you should think that it's a little bit shaky. We do not have any laws here. Like some states do have laws that say you will not do this. This is a wetland. These are the criteria, and you will not do the A, B, C, D, E, F, whatever to wetlands. Period. All right. The way our wetlands are protected are under a different water quality laws. All right. TDEC does it. So is the regulatory authority. If dredging causes pollution, then it is not permitted. So, if you do anything, whether it's dredging or filling an isolated wetland, if it's going to cause pollution, then, well, that's basically it. then, and we'll talk about what pollution is, then it can be regulated. How are isolated wetlands laws? All are laws protected. Over half of our wetlands are depressional or isolated wetlands. That's a good picture there of actually Playa Lakes. In Tennessee, isolated means that you are not connected to neighboring property owners by surface or groundwater. Okay? So, you are only isolated in Tennessee if you are truly isolated on your property. If surface water from your wetland, okay, flows off and goes onto another property owner, those waters are considered waters of the state and therefore can be regulated, including pollution. Okay? So only if it's contained within your property. It also includes groundwater, which most groundwater resources, if it's connected to the wetland, okay? If you have a groundwater source where there's connection with the wetland and the groundwater actually connects, then it's still considered not isolated. So pretty much they can almost, TDEC can pretty much almost regulate any water that exists. Okay? But technically, this is isolated. In fact, know that definition of isolation for the state of Tennessee. It has to be within your property boundaries, groundwater and surface water. Okay. The act in which wetlands are protected, the legislation in Tennessee where wetlands are protected, is called the Tennessee Water Quality Control Act, 1977. So it came about right around the time of the Clean Water Act. And it says, it recognizes that the waters of Tennessee are the property of the state and are held in public trust. States that people have the right to unpolluted waters. It defines waters of the state, defines pollution, and establishes the need for permits for the alteration of the physical, chemical, radiological, biological, bacteriological properties of the waters of the state. And TDUC enforces. If you're found in violation of this act in Tennessee, fines can be as great as $10,000 per day until it is reversed. These laws are much more restrictive than the federal laws, assuming that you interpret the following things, which are what are the waters of the state and what are pollution, what is pollution. Correspondingly, TDEC pretty much runs all the permitting in Tennessee, and then the Corps says, well, what do you guys think? If you approved it, we'll approve it. In other states, basically everything runs through through the Corps. So a lot of times, you know, agencies that regulate wetlands, being the Corps and a state agency, whatever it is, will work together because they'll both require permits. And whoever is the most restrictive, which is almost always going to be the state, okay, they'll let the state roll with it, and then and they'll help folks actually fill out the federal permits and everything. For Tennessee, you can fill out a state permit, and that's really all you need to do, and they'll help you with the federal permit. All right, so waters mean, okay, waters of Tennessee mean any and all waters, public or private, on or beneath the surface of the ground, except those bodies of waters confined and retained within limits of a private property in single ownership, which do not combine or affect a junction with natural surface or underground waters. So again, like we said, this is waters of the state. If it flows off your property and TDEC determines that, and then ultimately your waters are water. All right. So what do you do if you do something to that water, if you fill it in, this is pollution. Pollution, you ought to read this definition of pollution, is crazy. All right. Pollution means such alteration of properties of the waters that will result in harm to public health. Well, that is a concern. Safety or welfare, or will result in harm, potential harm, or the detriment to the health of animals, fish, birds, or aquatic life. Oh man, I must pulled off the other portion of it. Or, I don't know where the rest of it is. Anything that's microbial. So if you kill bacteria in the water, okay, you're causing pollution. I don't know why that's off. I don't know where it went. But so if it affects anything, if you do something to the water that changes its qualities, its physical qualities, its chemical qualities, if it affects the the zooplankton, phytoplankton, which obviously could then affect higher invertebrates, larger vertebrates, and vertebrates. I mean, you don't even need to have all that stuff. Just something way down there in the bottom, okay? Then it's called pollution. That means if you do anything, I'm telling you, if you graze your cattle technically in water, it is pollution at a very minimal level. Okay. Well, they haven't taken it to that level of okay. Now you can't let your cattle cannot have access at all to any surface water. Okay, you can still do that, but they could. They could say this is pollution and etc. Now, because if pollution is created through filling, then what you need is what's called an aquatic resources alteration permit. You are affecting the aquatic resources, you're altering those aquatic resources, and you need to have approval to do that because you're polluting the waters of the state. You have to have approval to pollute the waters of the state. And so if you're filling in a wetland, if you're dredging a wetland, you're potentially changing the water quality properties by adding extra sediment or changing the way that the water's flowing, changing those properties, then ultimately you need to get permission to do that. And it's called ARAP is the acronym. Okay, so you had a question, didn't you, Jeremy?
Yeah, T-Dave just came to talk to us in Shocker's class, and they were saying that there was an exemption for normal farming and silviculture practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for ARAP, yeah. 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 Yeah, so they could, I mean, underneath of the Water Quality Act of 77, they could enforce that, but they haven't. And I wasn't actually aware of the exemption, but that's good. Okay, cool. Other questions?
Just one quick question. So if you're farming in a wetland, for agriculture purposes, you can disc farming for agriculture purposes or cannot?
Okay, listen up, y'all. If you're farming, can you farm in a wetland, right?
Yeah, can you disc farm in a wetland?
Can you disc for agricultural purposes? And the answer to that is yes, you can. There is nothing illegal about farming in a wetland. If you're a biologist and you do it, you can't do it if you're a biologist without a nationwide permit. Okay? And if you're a farmer, if it floods out, you're not going to get any federal subsidies for that site. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, so let's take 5 minutes and then we'll start with some of the bird identification stuff, y'all.